Do me a favor and close your eyes. Everybody close your eyes for a second. What happens? Everything goes dark. Open your eyes, and everything is light again. With that in mind, let's read verse 22 through 24. The lamp of the body is the eye. If therefore your eye is good, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If therefore the light that is in you is darkness, how great is that darkness? No one can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will be loyal to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. Now, when you close your eyes, everything that we see is dark. The lights in the room don't turn off. We know that. We close our eyes. It's not that somebody hits a switch and all the lights go off. The sun is not blotted out. Not that we close our eyes and light ceases to exist in some way, but for you, inside your own mind, all is dark. So there is a sense in which you are illuminated by your eyes. So that when your eyes are open, you see light, and that affects everything that you see within. Your perception of your life and yourself is illuminated by your eyes. Now that may be, a little bit of that may be somewhat hard to grasp, but I think the basic principles are very clear. When our eyes are open, we have light. When our eyes are closed, we are in darkness. So there's as Jesus is saying, the lamp of the body is the eye. Your eyes are light bulbs, which illuminate your inner being. When your eyes are open, you can see to think, to move, and to decide. Now, as we age, our eyes get weaker. Things become less clear or increasingly dim. Certain ailments affect our eyes so that they may create black spots in our vision. What happens when you lose your sight completely? When you see nothing, your world becomes black. Now, thankfully, modern medicine is able to treat many of the ailments that afflict our eyes. I see a lot of people wearing eyeglasses. And probably a number of you have had various forms of eye surgeries. And there are a lot of things that we can do to treat many common ailments. But total blindness, where you see nothing, is a problem which still affects millions of people around the world, tens of thousands of Americans. And that's what Jesus is speaking about. That verse 23, he says, if your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If your eyes don't work, then everything within you is dark. But what happens when the problem is not the eye, but the light? As I think up to the middle of verse 23, Jesus' picture is fairly clear. Then he starts talking about this light that is in you being darkness. The only black light that I know of you can buy down at the local hardware store in different places, it's ultraviolet light, and you can use it and go up on Lake Superior and try to find uperlite rocks. That's not what Jesus is talking about. He's not talking about ultraviolet light, which is outside the range of normal human vision. He is using this illustration of physical light, of mental light, to illustrate moral light. So that we have a physical light which illuminates our life. We have a moral light which guides how we live. And this idea of moral light is mentioned several times in the New Testament. For example, in John 3:19, we are told that men love darkness rather than light because their deeds were evil. There's a direct connection between the darkness and the evilness. We see in John chapters 1 and chapter 8 and chapter 9, Jesus says, I am the light of the world. 1 John says, God is light, and in Him is no darkness at all. So we have the Bible using this picture of light to describe that which is pure, righteous, and holy. That picture of darkness to describe that which is sinful and wicked. So there is a moral quality being described with the terms light and darkness. Again, not that light itself, you know, which we get from our light bulbs is inherently moral, or that turning off the lights is inherently immoral, but that they're illustrations of that which is righteous and that which is wicked. That's what Jesus is talking about, that second half of verse 23, now talking about this moral light. What happens when your moral light is actually darkness? What we know it's tragic when there's physical blindness. It's a severe handicap. How much worse when there's a moral spiritual blindness? What happens when what a person believes to be good is actually evil? And when what a person believes to be evil is actually good? Physical blindness is tragic, but moral blindness is catastrophic. And that's what Jesus is referring to here in verses 22 to 24. And in my opinion, the entire Sermon on the Mount is a direct assault on the hypocrisy of the Pharisees. In Matthew chapter 5, Jesus declared the righteousness of the Pharisees was a false righteousness, unable to bring anyone into heaven. In the beginning of Matthew chapter 6, Jesus declared the piety of the Pharisees was a hypocritical devotion. And now in this part of chapter 6, so that we go from verses 19 to verse 34, Jesus is confronting what I think is one of the primary motivations of the Pharisees. We know that they were lovers of the praise of men, but they also were lovers of money. They were greedy. And I believe there are several hints of that in the Gospels. One of those we discussed actually several weeks ago when we talked about the Pharisees playing word games with their oaths. If you remember that, in Matthew chapter 5, Jesus is confronting the false swearing. And the Pharisees had this very technical procedures. If you swore on this, it was a binding oath. But if you swore by this, then it didn't really count. And the reason they did that was simple. So they would not have to fulfill their obligations. They were using it as a loophole to get out of their contract so they didn't have to pay what they owed. We see another example of their greed in the Old Testament or in the New Testament when they talk about their gifts of the things that they had. And they would sometimes say, well, this is dedicated to the temple. And they would use that as a justification for not caring for their elderly parents. Jesus said that they were violating the fifth commandment by saying, well, yeah, I know I have this, but actually it's dedicated to the Lord, so you can't have it. I can't care for you. I can't pay for your lodging. I can't make sure you have the medicine that you need because this is dedicated to the Lord. They weren't actually concerned about the things being dedicated to the Lord. They were concerned about keeping the things. And they were just using that as an excuse to justify not caring for their parents so they could keep their money. They loved their money, and they sought every possible means to make and keep as much of it as they possibly could. And the tragedy was that they believed their life was fine. They genuinely believed they were acting wisely in their pursuit of wealth. because their moral light was darkness. But they actually thought they were walking in the light. They were justified by their own moral principles. And consequently, they were condemned because what they believed to be moral is actually immoral. And that is deception of sin, is what Jesus is warning about when he says, if therefore the light that is in you is darkness, how great is that darkness? Jesus is warning of the incredible deceitfulness of sin. Sin convinces us that what is wrong is right, and that what is right is wrong. Sin comes with lots of excuses for why we have to sin. Sin has a whole pile of explanations of how living in sin is really the best way to live. And it is sin that works within our thinking and within our hearts so that we actually begin to think that the way of sin is the only way, or is the best way. And so someone who loves money will have many reasons, sometimes good reasons, why they have to devote their lives to the increase of their possessions. So there are certainly many times I've heard those who are devoted to money speak of and justify their sinfulness in terms of providing for their family, of giving their kids a better life, of putting together a secure retirement, of showing others the blessings of God. Now, hard work, good stewardship, wise planning, and diligent care for family are all good and necessary things. However, there are many Christians who use those right principles as justifications for their own sinful love of money. So that those good reasons, which should give us a proper attitude towards our finances and to our work, become blinders, which prevents the person from seeing he has made a good thing too important. And so the money lover, in fact, cannot imagine life without a certain dollar amount in the bank account, without a certain number of clothes in the closet, certain number of things or certain particular things in the garage, or a certain amount of food in the refrigerator. The money lover uses biblical principles like good planning to hide the fact that they're actually trusting their possessions rather than God. And that is what Jesus means by that light within being darkness. We internalize the darkness of sin and imagine it is actually light. And when we do that, we see the world wrong. To shift the analogy a little bit, because I think we might be able to understand this a little better than just complete blindness. Many people need corrective lenses. And maybe you, at some point in time, you realized things have gotten fuzzy. Maybe you didn't even realize and somebody else pointed out to you. And maybe you need to have your eyes checked. And things begin to look blurry when your eyes are weakening a little bit or when something's wrong with them. And sin blurs everything. And then it convinces us that the blurred image is actually the right one. So that sin tells you the letters on that big red octagon by the side of the road, they actually are supposed to be kind of fuzzy and indistinct. When somebody else comes along and says, no, those are clear, sharp, and crisp, you say, no, that's not how, they're supposed to be a little bit fuzzy. It's more aesthetic that way. They kind of flow into each other. It's supposed to look like that. And it is sin that does exactly that in our moral lives. It convinces us that blindness and bondage is the way to live, that life and liberty are actually worse. And it is that bondage to sin convinces us that living in sin is best, when in fact it is the worst way to live. That is the key statement, verse 24. That's what really everything in this portion hangs on. Jesus says at the end, you cannot serve God and mammon. Mammon is an Aramaic word that means riches. We understand in verse 24, Jesus is not talking just about money, but really he is contrasting mammon with God. He speaks of both as a master. And so as a result, we understand mammon to be more than money. But rather, in this passage, it is personified and deified. So that mammon is personified as a slaveholder. It is made as if it is a person. And in fact, that the issue here in verse 24, you go back to the beginning of it, he says, no one can serve two masters. The issue here is not a question between slavery and freedom, but in one master or another. The question is, to which master will you bind yourself? So then in Romans 6, we are told that all who are without Jesus are slaves to sin. And yet in the same chapter, Romans 6, we are also told that we are to present ourselves as slaves to God, slaves to righteousness. And the New Testament repeatedly uses that slave analogy to describe the Christian's relationship to God. Now, I know that word slave sounds a bit harsh to us. We're not troubled by referring to sin so much as a slavery. We know slavery's bad, and owning slaves is bad. So if sin is a slaveholder, that makes sense because sin's bad. And yet we are less comfortable with the idea of being slaves to God. We think God does not want slaves. And certainly we have the biblical concepts of liberty in Jesus that seem to argue against this idea of slavery. We also know that the Bible calls us servants as well. And many of us are more comfortable with that servant idea rather than the slave idea. But the Bible does command Christians to present themselves as slaves to God. And this understanding of ourselves as slaves is good for us. As we think of a servant, even a household servant, he might be doing menial tasks. He might be in a house under the direction of somebody else. But you know, he can always quit. He can always find another situation. He can leave if he wants to. But a slave can't. A slave cannot sell himself to another master. He is not his own owner. He does not have control of his own life, but rather another owns him. Another one has the full and final authority over the slave's life. And when you were saved, if you are the child of God, you were not set free from slavery to sin to go and live your own life. You were set free from the slavery to sin to become the slave of God, so that now you have a new master who has even more right to rule your life. 1 Corinthians chapter 6 tells us you are not your own, for you were bought with a price. Now, I will say the New Testament draws one huge difference between slavery to sin and slavery to God. Slavery to sin is involuntary. Sin slaves, enslaves us against our will. So the person might cooperate with it, but very few people willingly agree to become the slaves of sin. On the other hand, slavery to God is voluntary. He saves us, but He does not trick us into bondage. Rather, He requires us to voluntarily present ourselves to Him as His willing slaves who bind ourselves to Him because of our deep love for Him. So that your slavery to God is voluntary. However, again, Jesus does not permit us to think that we can choose between slavery to God and slavery to sin. We don't have the option there to decide between the two or think, well, there's a third option. I'll have the freedom to live however I want. What Jesus is teaching and what the New Testament clearly teaches is that we can present ourselves slaves to God or we will be slaves to sin. There is not a nice, comfortable middle road where we can have both of both sides without the bondage. If you want to think of it like that. We will be enslaved ourselves to God, or we will be enslaved to sin. And the specific sin in this passage is the love of money. So that if you pursue possessions, if you go back to verse 19, do not lay up your treasure for yourselves treasures on earth. But verse 20, lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven. If you pursue the earthly treasures, then you will be chained to materialism, greed, and discontent. And if your treasures are earthly, you will be enslaved by them. Your life will be controlled by the desire for a little bit more or for the next great thing. Your job will be your life, or your mind will be filled with how much money your investments are making, or you will be constantly looking for the thrill of the next Amazon delivery. It's always looking for that next thing. So you'll be unable to imagine yourself doing without certain things. You'll find that your very happiness depends upon a certain item. Your heart will be chained to the things that you possess or the things that you desire. And in fact, your things will no longer be your servants, which you use and use freely to accomplish good. Your things will become your master, which uses you to gather more and to store those things more securely. And the pivotal truth of this entire section of the Sermon on the Mount is this. Either we are willing slaves of God or the unwilling slaves of something else. If you would not be the slave of sin, you must present yourself as a slave to God. And the paradox is that when you enslave yourself to God, you find liberty. You find true liberty. So that bondage to God is liberating. Submission to God frees you from bondage to the hopelessness, the emptiness, the fearfulness, the purposelessness, and the dissatisfaction of slavery to this earth. You and I were not created to give our lives to temporary things. We were created to enjoy the eternal God. We were created to live forever. And it is only by living for God that we will enjoy the freedom of having a satisfying purpose. We will enjoy the peace of having an eternal aim. We will enjoy the joy of having an immortal treasure. And so which one, who will you serve? Jesus not only personified mammon, He also deified it. He personifies it by presenting it as a slaveholder. He deifies it by presenting it as if it is a god we worship. So again, that last phrase, you cannot serve God and mammon. He is laying up this contrast between a worship of the true God of heaven and the worship of treasures. What Jesus is saying is that devotion to earthly treasure is idolatry. It is idolatry of the same kind as bowing down before Baal, sacrificing your children to Molech, kneeling before Caesar's insignia, confessing there is no God but Allah and Muhammad is his messenger, or are burning incense to your ancestors. They're all idolatry. And this money loving, this treasuring the earth is also idolatry. Because idols are not just images. They are ideas. We would, I think, probably all recognize the world is full of money worshipers. But there are very few people, I've never met any, I'm assuming there might be one somewhere, but there are very few people who take and frame a $100 bill and put it on their wall, surround it with candles, and light candles every night, and bow down and pray to that $100 bill and offer incense and small offerings to it. That doesn't mean that we're not worshipers of money. Just because we don't have the altars and the temples of money does not make it any less of a national deity than Baal was in Canaan, or that Buddha might be in some other country. An idol is anything which takes the place of God in your life. So that in part, an idol is anything you trust as the ultimate source of what only God can give. An idol is anything you trust as that ultimate source of what truly comes from God. So an idol is something you trust to give you peace, or security, or satisfaction, or fulfillment, or joy. An idol is anything to which you devote your life. I mean, honestly, is that not how millions of people, millions of Christians view money? How many people do we know who imagine their happiness is dependent on making a little more money? Even though we know the old adage, it says money can't buy you happiness. Somebody else will very quickly reply, yes, I know, but I'd sure like to try anyway. It's that idea that money is going to bring me what I desperately need. How many people, their lives will spiral out of control when they lose their job or they lose the income that they were accustomed to? How many people complain bitterly about their lot in life because they do not have the money that somebody else has? Those who are worshipers of money trust it to give them what they desire most. Now, their love for money may drive them to work more and more hours so that they can get a promotion and finally be able to afford what they've dreamed of owning. The happiness of the money worshiper may rise and fall with the stock market. The contentment of the money worshiper may be dependent upon their ability to buy a new car every 3 years. The peace of mind of the money worshiper may be dependent on having a certain amount in the savings account. These are all evidences that of worshiping money. And if they're true of you, you need to look at your life and say, have I made this good thing, necessary thing, have I made it too important? Have I made it a god in your life? If you have, you've fallen into idolatry. And this issue of what we worship is the most important issue in all of scriptures. In the Ten Commandments, God forbade all forms of idolatry. He said in the second commandment, you shall not bow down to them nor serve them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generations of those who hate me. God is a jealous God, jealous for the proper worship of Him. He will not permit us to worship Him and idols. In fact, He says there that the worship of images is hatred of God. It is not just a divided love. He says it is a hatred. The Old Testament powerfully declares that all idolatry is spiritual adultery. What a graphic and very brutal image. So we know that for most of the Jews' history, they worshiped God and also the gods of the land. The Israelites did not stop worshiping God. They added in the worship of other gods. They worshiped multiple gods, including the God of the Bible, and God will not have that. He requires that we worship Him and Him alone, so much so that He declared the worship of other gods is unfaithfulness to Him. You would not think, I don't think any married person here would think it is okay for your spouse to be unfaithful to you as long as he remembered your birthdays and anniversaries and came back home on the weekends. It'd be completely unacceptable. You would not accept her adultery because she said that she loved you more than all of her other lovers. Marriage is utterly exclusive. And in the same way, the worship of God is absolutely exclusive. He will not have us worship God and gods. He will not have us come to Him on the weekend and worship our idols during the week. We must worship Him alone. We must be faithfully devoted to Him at all times so that you can either serve the God of wealth and possessions or the God of the Bible. You can either worship Jehovah or mammon. It's not a multiple choice test. There is no option C where you can say all of the above. This is a true or false test. You can worship the true God of the Bible or the false gods of the age. And that's your only options. So which one is your master? Which one is your true God? In verse 24, very, very briefly, Jesus gives us two diagnostics to help us evaluate the condition of our heart. They're the diagnostic test of service and love. He says, no one can serve two masters. Who do you serve? I touched on this last week, so I won't spend long on it, but who do you give your time and energy to? We all have some discretionary time where we choose what we do with that. How do you spend that time? When you have the freedom to decide how you will spend your day, what do you do with it? Now, I'm not saying, again, as I said last week, that every minute of every day has to be devoted entirely to explicitly religious things, so that if you're not at church, you have to be praying or reading your Bible, and that's all that counts. I'm not saying that at all. Scriptures doesn't teach that at all. In fact, Scriptures teaches us to use every moment, no matter what it is, for the glory of God. But the question is, how do you spend the majority of your discretionary time? What do you do with those days? If you spend your time, your idle moments, thinking about how you can get more stuff, you spend your time thinking or planning and working to get more goods, to store up more in some way, then you're serving mammon. You are giving your life and investing it in that. If you spend your time in intentional obedience to God and in seeking to please Him in every part of your life, then you are serving Him. The second question is, who do you love? Jesus says not only no man can serve two masters, He says He will hate the one and love the other. Do you remember which commandment Jesus says is the greatest? You shall love the Lord God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength. Loving God more than all else is the single most important duty of every person. In verse 21 of Matthew 6, he says, where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. He's showing that connection between our treasures and our heart. If you store your treasure on earth, your heart will be longing for that which is earthly. You will love the worldly. If you store your treasures in heaven, your heart will long for the heavenly. You will love the heavenly. So the question is, do you love God? Now, many people say they love God. Do you show it? Do you love God with every part of your life? So what stirs in your heart a longing, a desire, and a joy? Do you find delight in thinking about God and the things of God? Do your conversations about God have the same enthusiasm as your conversations about things? What do you enjoy doing? What do you spend your strength on? Is there within you an emotion, a desire, a thinking towards God? Do your words indeed show a love for God? Now, as you're thinking about this, don't forget that our flesh wars against the Spirit. So even as you're evaluating, do I love God? You will often feel a strong resistance to a deep love for God. And so do not be discouraged by a sense of conflict in your love for God. Your love for God is not an uncontrollable feeling which comes and goes on its own. There is a fleshly war against it, but your love for God is chosen. It is trained, corrected, and disciplined. Think of your love for God like a vine. You plant it. You have to give it a frame to climb. You will have to weed the ground around it. You might have to redirect it into climbing in the right direction or prune off certain branches that are dying, that are unhelpful. You have to train your heart and mind to love God. You have to weed the hindrances. You have to prune away the distractions. You have to direct your affections to truly love God with all of your being. So when I ask, do you love God? I'm not asking, do you always feel an emotional rush when you think about the things of God? Though I trust there are those moments in your lives where there's that incredible inward response to God. I'm asking, are you taking the time and trouble to learn God more fully? Do you hunger for the things of God? Do you truly long to know God better, to have a closer relationship with Him, to serve Him in more obediently and to be pleasing to Him? Do you fight for a close relationship with God? Do you invest the time needed to have an intimate fellowship with God? Do you discipline your habits so that you will have that time to walk with God and to serve Him? If you are pouring your time and energy into a relationship with God, that's an indication you have a proper love for Him. So examine what you invest your time in. Examine how you discipline your life. And see, do I truly love God? Because you have to make a choice. You have to make a choice as a Christian every single day. You will present yourself a living sacrifice to God, or you will submit yourself in slavery to sin. That's the daily option. Now, submission to God is far more profitable than idolizing riches. God will reward you with eternal rewards. Mammon will make you false promises of great benefit, but in the end, it will take away from you everything that is truly valuable. Devote your life to money. You will be disappointed on earth and empty-handed in heaven. devote your life to the Lord, you will have contentment on earth and abundance in heaven. So will you devote your life to that which is ultimately valueless, or to Him who is eternally valuable?